Hello, and thank you for joining this MedCast presentation titled Widening the Therapeutic Window in the Management of Parkinson's Disease. I'm Dr. Stuart Isaacson. I'm the director of the Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorder Center in Boca Raton, Florida.
Hi, and I'm Dr. Rajesh Pawar, Professor of Neurology and Director of the Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorder Center at the University of Kansas Medical Center, Kansas City, Kansas.
Today, our discussion will focus on strategies available to widen the therapeutic window of Parkinson's disease. We'll discuss options available to treat dyskinesia and to provide better control of off periods in Parkinson's disease. Joining us in this conversation is Dr. Robert Hauser. He is a professor of neurology and the director of the Parkinson's and Movement Disorders Center at the University of South Florida College of Medicine in Tampa, Florida. Thanks so much for joining us, Bob. And
Oh,
let's
my pleasure.
begin.
Thank you.
Let's begin with you, Bob. You've had a more than a few years of experience in managing Parkinson's disease, but when we think about the long-term management of Parkinson's disease in our patients, what are some of the challenges you think really need to be faced?
Yeah, well, when I see a patient and we make the diagnosis of Parkinson's disease, a lot of times they'll ask, well, what am I looking at? What am I facing long term? And I usually will say something like this, and this is just an approximation, and it's kind of the average patient over the long term. And I'll say, well, the medications we have today usually do a pretty good job for the first 5 years or so. Between 5 and 10 years, most patients are developing motor fluctuations where they vary between the on state where they're getting a good response to medication and the off state where medication is worn off and they experience a return of Parkinsonian motor signs, slowness, stiffness, tremor. And also during the latter part of that 5 to 10 year period, especially, many patients develop dyskinesia, which looks like a sensitivity to dopaminergic medication. And then beyond that time, beyond 10 years, many patients develop major complications, including balance difficulty with falls and cognitive decline and dementia. And we really don't have good treatments for those. And I often say, well, this is where we really need to slow disease and one day stop it. And that's why we're doing so much new research to try and accomplish those things. And I often invite them to clinical trials to help us evaluate new medications that might be able to do that.
We have known about these motor fluctuations and dyskinesias. What do you think are the mechanisms behind it, and why are we still struggling as far as controlling the motor fluctuations and dyskinesias?
Yeah, well, we have made some strides, but to answer your question about the mechanisms, they arise principally from two things. One is the cornerstone of treatment in early disease is still carbidopa/levodopa immediate release. And we have the problem that it's highly effective, but its half-life is short. So levodopa alone has a half-life of 60 minutes. We typically give it with carbidopa, and that extends its half-life to 90 minutes, but that's still very short. And I think of it as really providing a concentration of therapeutic zone for only about 2.5 hours or so. But as you know, when we give it in early disease, let's say every 5 hours or so, maybe 7 a.m., noon, 5 p.m., patients will get a good response regarding bradykinesia and rigidity, maybe not tremor, but for those other motor features. And they'll say, good job, doctor or care provider. I'm getting a good response. It's lasting from dose to dose, even though the serum concentration is going up, peaking, and then going down with that 90-minute half-life. And the reason for this, we believe, is because levodopa finds its way up to the brain, gets into remaining dopamine neurons, is converted to dopamine, and most importantly, is stored and slowly released over time to fill that gap going from dose to dose. But what happens over time is patients are losing dopamine neurons, and they begin to lose that capacity to store dopamine derived from levodopa, and they don't have that capacity to store and release through those hours. So patients begin to say, hey, doc, it's not lasting 5 hours anymore. It's lasting 4.5 hours, and then I wear off, or 4 hours, and then I wear off. And as time goes on, that good duration of benefit gets shorter and shorter and shorter until they're really fluctuating up and down in concert with those serum levodopa concentrations. And then there are a few other things that make the situation even worse. You know, Parkinson's disease is not just in the brain. It's also in the nerves to the GI system and within the GI system. So patients often have gastroparesis, and levodopa has to get past the esophagus, past the stomach, into the small intestine where it gets absorbed. And when the patients have slow motility through the stomach or gastroparesis, that creates problems that it takes longer for that next pill to get to the small intestine to get absorbed. And it also introduces variability. So patients begin to say, hey, it takes a half an hour or 45 minutes or an hour till that next pill kicks in. And I can't depend on it kicking in. Sometimes it might be half an hour. Sometimes it might be an hour. Sometimes it might kick in at all because it might get caught in the stomach. So all of those things add up to create motor fluctuations. And then we have the problems that dyskinesia occurs, and we think that's related to the fact that we're exposing those postsynaptic dopamine receptors to these fluctuating levels of dopamine, and that creates that sensitivity over time that's expressed as dyskinesia, which I call sort of twisting, turning movements that patients then exhibit.
You know, I talk about the window, right, the therapeutic window that we have. And initially, it's wide. The difference between the patients having off time and dyskinesias is too far apart. And that's why we don't see hardly any off time or dyskinesias initially. And as the disease progresses, this window keeps getting narrower and narrower. So, you know, it's the narrowness of the window that really are the challenges that the patients start having, along with the other mechanisms that you talked about, the short half-life, the gut making the absorption more erratic. So the patient is basically going between off, on with dyskinesias. Do we have options to widen the window so that our patients don't have the fluctuations and dyskinesias?
Yes, it's such a good point you bring up, Raj. I say this idea of widening the window, because everything, Bob, you just described happens at the beginning of Parkinson's. These fluctuations up and down, the pulsatile stimulation, the levels in the bloodstream, you know, this you know, path that this little yellow pill has to take through the esophagus and the stomach and the intestine, competition with dietary amino acids and metabolites and getting across the blood-brain barrier and finding its way to neurons, being converted to dopamine and released. That all happens from the get-go, but the window's so wide that it's not clinically meaningful. You don't see a clinical outcome from that. It's as this disease progresses and that narrowing of that window occurs, that the same problem that was there from the get-go now is causing clinical problems. So I think widening the window would be of a different way of thinking about the classic way of trying to give fractionated, lower the peak and raise the trough and try to get as infusion-like as possible. But if we had some way of widening the window, getting it back to where it was at the beginning of Parkinson's, that would be another way of thinking about treatment.
Yeah, exactly. So when I think about this, I think the classic concept, and I didn't talk about this in mechanism, but there is another mechanism at play, and that's glutamate. And there's increasing glutamate stimulation over time on the dopamine system. And I think of that as turning up the gain on this whole problem. And it makes off worse, and it makes dyskinesia worse. And that's part of this narrowing of the therapeutic range. So what comes to mind when I think of increasing that therapeutic range is the medication amantadine. And we now have amantadine extended release capsules. And that's the one medication that is approved to treat both dyskinesia and off. So I think that fits the definition of extending or expanding or widening that therapeutic zone.
So can we, and I always think about it, because there is data out there suggesting, like Stu mentioned, if we can thread the levels of levodopa in the narrow window that's there initially, we can also widen the window after a while. In other words, providing more continuous stimulation, or using other techniques like surgery, for example. So that really works in a very different manner. Is that we are widening this window because with the chronic stimulation, we are cutting down the supersensitivity, so to speak, of the postsynaptic receptors? Are we resetting the glutamate that's out there? Is it some other gene that we are changing? Because that could be another way to change the window or widen the window, right?
Yeah, I think you bring up a really important point. When you have this target zone, this window, we normally think about trying to thread that zone and keep the levodopa levels right in that target. But if you think about what's really happening, for example, with carbidopa, levodopa, enteral pump, you don't get those levels right in between where they would be with oral. They're really much higher. And what we're seeing is this idea of if you deliver levodopa and dopamine to the brain in this continuous fashion, that keeps these troughs from occurring. So you take care of the off, and it looks like you can get over time less dyskinesia. So it looks like you're depriming the system and reversing that sensitivity that sets that low bar of levodopa concentration, that narrowing of that upper threshold for dyskinesia. So I think that really is an example of widening the therapeutic zone.
This hyperglutamatergic state that you brought up, Bob, that these so-called upregulated glutamate receptors, the NMDA receptors that are on these postsynaptic neurons that modulate the outflow from the striatum. If we reduce that glutamate, that's a therapeutic target. I guess that's sort of perhaps what DBS is aiming to do with STN, subthalamic nucleus stimulation, perhaps. But pharmacologically, how would we approach that?
Yeah, so the idea is to block or inhibit NMDA receptors. And again, the medication that does that is amantadine. Amantadine IR, there's some limited information that reduces dyskinesia and also has a anti-bradykinesia effect. And then, as I mentioned, amantadine ER capsules, there's a very robust set of data indicating that it both reduces off time and reduces dyskinesia. So I think that's your great example.
And, you know, personally, I look at amantadine, especially amantadine DR in my patients who have off time and dyskinesias as really helping from both angles, reducing their off time as well as reducing their dyskinesias. Because one of the challenges we have when we talk about treating the dyskinesias is we can cut down the levodopa, we can cut down the individual doses of levodopa and cut down the dyskinesias, but the end result is the patient has more off time. And using an adjunctive therapy such as amantadine DR-ER, we can help both their off time as well as the dyskinesias. So to me, that has been a good option to consider. You know, Bob, you bring up a very important point about IR versus ER amantadine. And if I look at some of the data that's out there with the dyskinesias, I do see a reduction with IR, but I don't see the same thing with IR reduction of off time. And I don't know why that is the case, because is it the pharmacokinetics? Is it the delivery? Or is it just the studies have not been there to show that reduction? So at least today, clinically, I kind of, in my mind, differentiate that as if I have to reduce both the off time and dyskinesias, I think the data is much, much more robust for amantadine ER, which I'm not sure if we have that for IR.
How do you decide when to even think about a treatment such as amantadine ER? Does any degree of dyskinesia, does it have to be all day long, or does it have to be severe? Is it, how do you classify dyskinesia? Is the troublesome and non-troublesome dyskinesia? Is it by frequency of the duration, the severity? I don't know if we've really thought about characterizing dyskinesia in the same way that we've thought about off.
So first of all, with regard to what Raj said, applied to your question, one issue is if a person has dyskinesia that you want to treat and they have no off and their motor movement is good, you do have the opportunity to lower dopaminergic therapy and see where you're at. You may find that they're just receiving more medication than is necessary, and there may be room to reduce dopaminergic therapy, and you may find you're in a better place. Now, short of that, there becomes a question of what is the impact of the dyskinesia? Is this something you want to try to reduce symptomatically? And, I coined the term troublesome dyskinesia for diary purposes many years ago. And so I think if a person says my dyskinesia is causing a problem, whether it's a functional problem, it interferes with this activity, or I don't like it for some other reason, whether I don't like the appearance of it, or it's uncomfortable for me. I think that's certainly a reason to try to reduce it. There are other interesting associations for dyskinesia that the patient may not be totally able to assess. For example, dyskinesia is associated with falls. I don't know that a patient can really say, hey, my dyskinesia is causing falls. That might just be a risk factor that would be really hard for them to assess. But beyond that, if a patient says the dyskinesia is causing them difficulty, I would definitely think about what can I do about it? And then we have to ask the question, well, do they also have off? And if they already have off, then I think you have to recognize that if you're going to try to reduce dopaminergic therapy in the traditional sense, they're likely to experience more off. And this is where amantadine, I call it ER capsules, you mentioned it's sometimes called DREER, comes to the fore. Or something like something that will deliver levodopa in a more constant fashion, whether it's continuous levodopa enteral infusion or something else that might be approved in the future. So that's that part of it. But the other thing that's really important, as you know, is that dyskinesia also represents a barrier to us treating off better. So you may see a patient who says, well, I've got a little bit of dyskinesia, it doesn't bother me. And they may actually talk more about the off periods. You may be thinking about, well, how do I treat the off? And you have to recognize in that patient, if you increase dopaminergic therapy to treat off, they're going to experience more dyskinesia. And there you have to make a judgment. Well, is there any room to allow more dyskinesia before it becomes a problem or more troublesome? And often the answer is no, there's no room there. And that again is a patient. Well, what medications or what treatments do we have that treat both off and dyskinesia? And I think we've mentioned them. It's amantadine, particularly amantadine ER capsules. It's a continuous form of levodopa delivery, or it's DBS. So those are the things that you'd be thinking about.
So, Bob, do you have an ideal patient in your mind? Because often people ask us, who is a candidate for amantadine DR? To me, in my mind, it is like, okay, someone who has dyskinesias and off time, to me, that's the first drug that would come to mind because that's the only one indicated both for off as well as dyskinesias. But do you have a particular patient in mind when if I had to ask you, who's your ideal candidate for amantadine DREER capsules?
Yeah, definitely. When you see a patient with both off and dyskinesia, you're trying to treat, that comes to the fore. But remember, the primary side effect is hallucination. So the other part of it is you ideally you'd like to see a patient without hallucinations, a patient who has good cognition, and these tend to be young patients, and younger patients have good kidney function. They tend also to be able to tolerate higher doses. So that's the super ideal patient. Now, the problem or challenge that we face is, if you remember what I said at the beginning of this, as time goes on, those are the patients as they progress that develop fluctuations and dyskinesia. Unfortunately, time from diagnosis is also associated with development of cognitive problems and hallucinations. So we often don't have our choice when this comes. And we see a lot of patients we see who have both off and dyskinesia. And we say, aha, let's try amantadine DREER. But gosh darn, there are also the patients who've got cognitive problems. They may have a history of hallucinations, so they wouldn't be ideal candidates. So, off and dyskinesia, younger, cognitively intact, no hallucinations, those would be the super ideal patients. And before we leave that ideal candidate, you know, if you're dealing with a younger patient and they just have OFF or they just have dyskinesia, I do want to point out that OFF and dyskinesia are really opposite sides of the same coin. And one of the things that is evident when you look at data is that the development of OFF as a patient moves through their journey is a risk factor for the development of dyskinesia, and the presence of dyskinesia is a risk factor for the development of OFF. And their mechanisms are intimately linked together. So if you see a young person who develops either one of these, they're pretty highly likely to develop the other. So when you're thinking about treatments, especially dyskinesia, you want to think about amantadine DRER because they're going to develop OFF. And even a young person who just develops OFF, if they're young, they're likely to develop dyskinesia in the future too. So I wouldn't take that off the table as well.
I think another patient I think about a lot, and people who have had previous or prior dyskinesia. Maybe it's when we increase the dose of levodopa. Maybe it's when we added it on extender at some point, and then we sort of backed off and did this trade-off, and now we want to treat off again. And because of the having that dual indication, not only for dyskinesia, but amantadine DRER also has that indication for off. It's the only off therapy that does not have a risk of increasing dyskinesia. Most of the medications, when you add them on, have a 15% or so risk of dyskinesia emerging. So, in someone who's had prior dyskinesia, especially when it's limited treatment options or therapy, I think of the amantadine DRER as something that can treat the off without a risk of dyskinesia. If anything, would lessen it.
And I think a very important point you brought up was the renal function. I think a lot of physicians forget that when we are talking about amantadine, we need to keep the renal function in mind. And as you mentioned, you know, the older patients, and maybe using a very small dose of amantadine might provide them with benefits of dyskinesias without worsening of cognition or causing hallucination. So to me, that has always been in my mind that if someone is older, start at a very small dose and then try to adjust it rather than you know, starting at one dose and increasing it like we do with every other patient. So I think that is something clinicians should keep in mind as far as renal clearance goes.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, one thing I like to teach is that when you take a general population age 70 and above, 50% of individuals have a creatinine clearance below 60. So if you're not going to check creatinine clearance, you should assume that in this older population, the creatinine clearance is below 60. And those are the numbers. But even without that, like you say, as a strategy, it makes a lot of sense to start at a low dose. So I think that's one of the keys to successfully using it.
It's a really important point is that we have to individualize not only the treatment selection, but the dosing. And, you know, Raj, you brought up that this is delayed and extended. How does that work? Because I think that feeds into our understanding of its clearance.
Right. So that's the other thing. It's the pharmacokinetic. It's the shape of the curve, so to speak. A lot of the extended release preparation, I look at it, are more of a convenience one. You know, instead of three times a day, it's once a day. The pharmacokinetic is basically having it that it doesn't dip during the day. It provides it more continuously during the day. Amantadine DRER, which is a delayed release, extended release, you take it at bedtime. So the levels gradually go up at night. So when the patient wakes up in the morning, the levels are at a reasonable level, and then they slowly fall off during the day. So in a way, it is when the patient wakes up in the morning, the levels are high enough that they are seeing benefits in dyskinesias right from the time they wake up. So it could be related to the pharmacokinetics of amantadine, that's why they're getting better benefit with DRER versus IR. So that's another way I look at it. It could be the potential benefit of DRER versus IR.
And how is that different than the immediate release generic formulation that's available?
So the immediate release, basically, you wake up, you take the pill, you wait for the levels to rise up, you take the second dose when the levels begin to fall down. Your second peak goes higher. And if you take a third dose, your third peak is even higher. So there, your levels are at the peak later in the day more close to the evening. And then, you know, in certain countries like in Europe, they don't recommend taking a dose of amantadine after 4 p.m. because of the issues of sleep-related concerns, the dream, the worsening of REM behavior. So you are ending up trying to either use lower doses or using higher doses during the morning hours and not dosing them later in the day.
You know, one thing that's interesting in listening to you talk about this, Raj, is we mentioned that levodopa, when you don't give it continuously, it's the ups and downs that seem to be associated, well, with both fluctuations, but dyskinesia as well. We haven't really thought about that very much with amantadine, and certainly the pharmacokinetics of amantadine DRER when given daily, there's much less variation and fluctuations. We may be getting some benefit of continuous, quote unquote, amantadine administration, which you may not be getting with IR when you let the concentrations fall low in the morning and then try to build it back up through the day. Now, I must say this is highly speculative, but I just am recognizing the parallel with continuous levodopa administration as we're talking about it here today.
So pulsatility at the glutamate receptor may not be as efficacious in your speculation. I agree with you.
My speculation, yeah.
And I agree with you. I think that I think when we talk about the clinical development of DRER amantadine, we were struck by that it not only improved dyskinesia, but it also improved off. But it really improved good on time. And improved good on time after 2 weeks of use by about 4 hours a day, making half the day good on time to three quarters of the day, 4 hours more good on time by taking a bedtime dose of amantadine DRER seemed to be a large magnitude response. And I'm not sure we've really explained why there's such a large magnitude response to that single bedtime dose. And it may reflect a receptor biology.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm not sure amantadine IR doesn't have an off effect. It hasn't really been looked at that way. It probably has an anti-bradykinesia response, but doesn't seem at least to be of that magnitude. And like you say, amantadine DRER has a very robust magnitude of effect. And one of the analyses we did, we looked at patients in the phase three clinical trials who were experiencing the so-called criteria for advanced therapies, 5-2-1. Let's see if I can get it right. Five administrations of levodopa, 2 hours of off, and an hour of dyskinesia. And the benefit was very close to what you see with DBS. And it's a very robust response.
Yeah. You know, there has been some very interesting data recently that using amantadine earlier, even before the patients develop dyskinesias, we can delay the onset of dyskinesias. Is it time that we started treating patients before they actually have dyskinesias in order to prevent dyskinesias, or using it very early where the dyskinesias are not bothersome for them? Because to me, it is time we started thinking about something like that, because not only we are improving the motoric symptoms of PD using them earlier, but if we can prevent the long-term challenges that we know we are going to face as the window is narrowing. What do you think, Bob?
Yeah, I think it's a really important question. You know, the first thought when one hears this is, well, you know, is it just pre-treating dyskinesia? And I think there's some data available to say, well, maybe not, because delayed start may not do as well. I don't think we've fully inspected that data, so maybe a little bit premature to conclude it one way or the other. And the data that I'm referring to is amantadine IR data, not amantadine DRER data. So, you know, I think one can make a really good argument that a clinical trial looking at this question with amantadine DRER with a delayed start component could be a really valuable question and answer to ask and answer to try and get at this. And, you know, there are going to be more medications that do something similar with less long-term side effects, less effects on cognition and hallucination. So I think this is going to become an even more important question as newer drugs are developed.
What new agents or new mechanisms of action are under investigation now for dyskinesia and good on time? Are there things that you're excited about, new things coming?
Well, I'll start with dyskinesia, and actually it turns out there aren't that many true anti-dyskinesia medications in the pipeline. I'll highlight two that are sort of between phase two and phase three. One is mesdopetam, which is a D3 antagonist, which is kind of interesting. So that's one to watch out for. And then there's this whole succession of 5-HT1A agonists. They've had sort of mixed results. Many of them are partial agents, and they've worsened Parkinsonism. But there is one now, befiridol, which is a full 5-HT1 agonist that in animal studies does not worsen Parkinsonism, seems to have an anti-dyskinetic effect. And again, it's in between phase stage two and three. Phase two and three. And so it's headed to phase three trials. So that looks interesting as well. And then there's some agents that may be a little bit different, may not be anti-dyskinetic per se, but may hold some promise in avoiding dyskinesia. And one is tavapadon, which is a D1, D5 partial dopamine agonist. And the hope there is it could potentially have pretty robust anti-Parkinsonian effect and avoid or have less development of dyskinesia. So those kinds of medications could be very useful. And then we mentioned earlier, at least in the context of carbidopa levodopa enteral suspension, that kind of continuous levodopa delivery seems to have the potential to deprime patients and reduce dyskinesia potentially over weeks to months. And so, as you know, here in the States, we're about to get a number of subcutaneous infusions, levodopa carbidopa, fos levodopa, fos carbidopa, which are prodrugs, and apomorphine infusions. So all of those, I think, have the potential to both reduce off and dyskinesia. And then as we talk about fluctuations per se, we have carbidopa levodopa extended release, but we're going to see the next even longer extended release oral medication, which is IPX203, whereas carbidopa levodopa extended release, each administration provided an increase in duration of benefit compared to IR of 1.2 hours. This new medication, IPX203, extended duration of benefit by 1.5 hours. So it looks like it's even more long acting. And it looks like with about four doses per day, maybe even with oral medication, we can get pretty continuous delivery. Should have a pretty robust effect on reducing off. And perhaps then we may be able to get some reduction in dyskinesia, although that would be highly speculative as well.
Can you clarify the increase in on per dose again, Bob? Of IR and the IPX203?
Yeah. So when you look at increase in duration of on per dose, IPX203 increased on per dose by 1.5 hours per dose.
And, compared to
comparing that to the currently available medication, carbidopa levodopa extended release. That medication, the analysis showed it increased on per dose by 1.2 hours. So again, that gives me the frame of mind that the new IPX203 probably will be longer acting. So there you go.
That's a lot of stuff to look forward to this year. Hopefully we'll see their approvals and have more things to talk about. Some closing thoughts, Raja, any advice you'd like to share with the clinicians or with patients and thinking about dyskinesia and choosing when to treat and when to think about using amantadine DRER?
I think, you know, one of the challenges has been the dyskinesias. Patients have been levodopa phobic, not trying to use levodopa because of dyskinesias and being undertreated. We didn't have any medication that was approved for dyskinesias before. So having a drug approved both for off time and dyskinesias gives us our patients and options, the clinicians and options, to use a drug where if a patient has dyskinesias, especially along with off time, they can use amantadine DRER to help with that. Of course, the dose of levodopa can be reduced to reduce the dyskinesias, but the challenge behind that always ends up that the patient's quality of on could get worse or they could have more off. So I think we should be comfortable in using medications, even though the amantadine is an old medication. Actually, it works, we feel better with the newer formulation than the older IR formulation.
Well, Bob and Raj, it was great chatting about this emerging way of thinking about managing Parkinson's disease, not just trying to thread that window, but another option trying to widen the therapeutic window. Hopefully you all enjoyed listening to this and found it educational. And thanks for listening to this MedCast presentation.